This is Judaism Unbound, episode 41, History and Memory. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofus.
We're here today for a kind of standalone episode that we think is going to help us bridge where we've been over the last few months and where we're going over the next few months. We're here with Dr. Yehuda Kurtzer, who is the president of the Shalom Hartman Institute of North America. Through his work at the Hartman Institute, Yehuda is helping us very broadly as a community think about the Jewish past, present, and future. And it's a project that he began before his time at the Hartman Institute. When I first met him, he was a PhD student at Harvard who was working on some of these ideas. And soon thereafter, he won a competition to become the inaugural chair of Jewish communal innovation at Brandeis University, through which he wrote his first book, Shuvah, The Future of the Jewish Past. We are excited to talk to Yehuda today to start to make those connections between the past, present, and future more explicit, and welcome you to the show. Thanks, Yehuda, so much for being with us on Judaism Unbound.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. You know, I think that, well, we're probably about 8 months into the podcast at this point, and we wanted to start taking some steps back, big picture, try to start talking to some folks who are really looking at what's going on in the Jewish world today, how that connects to essentially all of Jewish history in a kind of big picture way. And clearly you're a major figure in looking at that whole picture. And I don't know if this is a helpful way to start, but I'm thinking back to when we first met, and there had just recently been announced a competition by the Charles Bronfman Foundation and Brandeis University about somebody who would write, potentially write a book about a big Jewish idea, and that person would be given a few years at Brandeis as a visiting professor to write that book and to develop that idea, and you won that competition. And I'm wondering if maybe that's a place to start in terms of thinking back to that period and saying, you know, you had something to say at that point about what you were seeing going on in the Jewish world and how you thought that connected to some important big ideas.
Sure. So that was actually a really important turning point in my life. At the time, I was a doctoral student studying ancient Jewish history at Harvard, and I knew at the time when I was doing my doctoral work that I was actually much more interested in a contemporary conversation than I was in what I was studying, which is actually not a great way to do a PhD in ancient Jewish studies. It was complicated, but I was really trying to do rigorous academic work, knowing that the questions that I was asking were questions of which I was interested in their contemporary ramifications. At the time, I was studying ancient Jewish diasporas and their relationship to the emerging centers in then ancient Roman Palestine and Babylonia. It still interests me as a theoretical question that you had this incredibly diverse and complicated Greek-speaking diaspora that's largely been lost to Jewish history, because we have this story that has been told through a kind of interesting conspiracy of early Christianity and rabbinic Judaism that imagines that Judaism is only in two places, in the land of Israel and in Babylonia. So I was trying to excavate that in my doctoral work and to figure out who are these Jews? What's their relationship to these emerging centers? And what's the transaction look like across the ancient Jewish world? And so you can hear, even as I'm talking about it, that I was interested in these communities not just as a historical artifact, but as metaphor or even worse, precedent. And I was also doing, you know, a bunch of teaching on the side, but it still felt to me, and this has been my kind of critique of the academy, it's not my own, other people have made it, that the teaching that I was doing was still segmented as being a totally different discipline from the academic work. And I knew at the time that I was finding the teaching fulfilling in a very different way than it is traditionally commodified in the academy. It was actually where I felt ideas were coming alive. And so I was teaching in the rabbinical school, Hebrew College, while I was, you know, do my research in the morning and then go teach in the afternoon or the evening. And I was looking for a way to bridge between those worlds, that the teaching should drive the research and the research should drive the teaching. And all of those, you know, those both of those should be animated by the relevance of ideas to the living of contemporary Jewish life, and not just as not just history as curiosity, but really history as a discourse that changes how we think about the present. So when Brandeis created this position, and it was really kind of a strange position. This was pre-economic crisis. Charles Bronfman teamed up with Brandeis to create this position that they called a chair in Jewish communal innovation. This was right at the height of the when that language of innovation was in major use in the Jewish community. We can talk about that further on. And the idea was to bring somebody on board who, as you said, would stimulate the public Jewish conversation with ideas. Now, in retrospect, you'd have to talk to the funders about this, but I think that they had a little bit more of a programmatic goal in mind. I think there was a lot of excitement, you know, at that time that Birthright had made such a big impact on the Jewish community that maybe somebody would come to campus and create the next Birthright. But that's not really what's going to draw somebody to a university position. I'm not sure that's the best way to cultivate programmatic innovation. But for me, this was an opportunity to actually write the book that while I was writing my doctorate, I really wanted to write, which was to go up on the balcony and ask the kind of meta question, which is, what's the relationship between the Jewish past, the Jewish present, and the Jewish future? Where oftentimes I find that future tense conversations, and I think you guys with your work are right in the heart of this. Oftentimes conversations that position themselves about the future of Jewish life are deeply disconnected from the Jewish past and oftentimes highly critical of the Jewish present. And at the same time, people who care about the Jewish past are oftentimes ignorant of contemporary trends or dismissive of the direction that Jewish life is going into. And I've felt, I think this is borne out by our tradition, that the secret sauce of Jewish innovation has classically been the ability to intertwine, reframe, reimagine what the past means in order to be able to serve a kind of authenticity of the present.
Could you kind of give us a sense of, from your perspective, what do you think the people who are listening to this podcast, you know, people who are thinking about the Jewish future, particularly those who are either not strongly connected to existing forms of Jewish life today, or, you know, what we found is a lot of our listeners are connected to existing Jewish institutions, but sort of, I guess I would say uncomfortably so. They have a gnawing sense that something is wrong and that something needs to be changed rather dramatically, but aren't necessarily sure how to think beyond that. And so I'm curious if you could walk us through some of the areas that you think are most important in thinking about those questions.
I encounter throughout my work, and I think that many of your listeners fall into this category too, many people who are seeking serious Jewish content and meaning and learning in their lives and are not convinced that the classical frameworks in which meaning and belonging and spirituality are located are the obvious places that they should have to go to in order to find those activities. This is not to say that there aren't great synagogues, which I think there are, and great rabbis, which I think there are, and great communal institutions, and so forth, but that it's no longer obvious to people in search of meaning that they have to belong to those institutions in order to locate that meaning. And that, I think, is a fascinating moment, and it's also a huge opportunity. What naturally lends itself to happen is that institutions, you know, who think of them, who are essentially organisms and need human capital in order to survive, may, if they're successful, pivot into the marketplace and build the structures of community, meaning, and spirituality that people will want to in order to participate. But most will not, because they're thinking in terms of human capital as opposed to the kinds of outcomes that they want to create. And that's where I think we are. I think it's been the case for a while in the American Jewish community. I think it's becoming more visible now, where you have more and more institutions who are serving the big messages that Jews want, meaning, community, spirituality, all those things. There are more and more interventions that are serving what people want, and fewer institutions that are able to claim a perpetual membership just because they've served those functions effectively in the past.
And could you just, as a last point of introduction, talk a little bit about, your big idea of history and memory that occupy a significant part of your book, Shuva. And just thinking about this question of how should we be thinking about the past when we think about the present and future?
Sure. So the distinction that I draw between history and memory, which is not something that I think I came up with on my own, and I put myself, hopefully, in a trajectory of a lot of thinkers who have tried to confront this issue, is that I find history to be not necessarily dispassionate in the sense that people are not deeply invested in what they're doing, but much more interested in actually understanding the past on the assumption that the role of the modern is to transcend it. And the extent that it's informing, it tells us about what happened in the past on the assumption that whatever's going to happen in the present is going to be somewhat different. There's an implicit condescension in history, which is a kind of unpacking of what happens before on the assumptions that we no longer need to be bound by it. What defines the memory discourse as it has animated classical Jewish thought has been an interest in telling a narrative version of the past precisely as driven by the needs and motivations that serve the present. And the best data point for this is in the construction of the modern Jewish memory holidays of Yom HaZikaron, Israel's Memorial Day for its fallen, Yom HaShoah, our Memorial Day for the Holocaust, and even Yom HaTzmaut, Israel's Independence Day, which are modern memory holidays that don't look anything like the classic memory holidays of the Jewish past. And so in the book, I talk about the distinction between the activities that one does on Passover and the activities that one does on Yom HaShoah, on Holocaust Memorial Day. Passover is entirely a holiday of a discursive relationship to the past where you never really talk about the past at all. And it's kind of a great mystery of the Haggadah that at the Passover Seder, you never actually tell the story of the Exodus from Egypt. You tell the story of other people telling stories about the Exodus, as if to say, we don't really care what happened. We care about the larger themes of freedom and liberation and oppression as they navigate themselves through our lives and our politics and our choices. And it's no surprise then that when it's done effectively over time, it's the holiday that more American Jews and, frankly, more American non-Jews are going to participate in more than anything else because it's alive. Whereas, paradoxically, Yom HaShoah, our Holocaust Memorial Day, is a passive activity of listening, oftentimes to survivors. And the pedagogy tells a very big story of what it is that we think that we're doing on these days, on the assumption of if we hear what a survivor has to say, we're never going to forget. Well, that's just not true. When your whole job is listening to the past and having the past narrated, and I would go even one step further, when our entire mission is trying to make sure that a particular version of the past is preserved, not only is it less likely that people will remember that story, but over time, as the historical record gets edited and modified, then the very value proposition of trying to remember the past as something that has that is fixed, that has a clear integrity, that we know exactly what happened, starts to show itself as being something implausible. I understand how in ancient Jewish history, Jews could have this theory of memory because their theories of history were less refined than they are today. But can you have a kind of post-Enlightenment, post-scientific revolution, Once we have a very different history-type consciousness as modern people, can we rehabilitate this sensibility of memory, which is by definition much more selective, much more political, much more driven by our contemporary needs? And I was trying to argue that yes, we can, and B, we must.
I really appreciated the distinction you drew between history and memory in Shuva. I think it's important. And one concept that you discussed here and there in the book that I think might be related, and I'd love to hear your expansion, is this idea of continuity. So in looking at the Jewish past and present and future. We, one of those buzzwords that we talk about a lot on this show and in many other contexts and from many different angles is this idea of continuity, to preserve that which has existed in the past such that it continues into the future. And I'm curious if you think that the discourse that has existed in the Jewish community about continuity relates at all to some of the pitfalls of history or some of the distinctions you've drawn between history and memory just earlier.
Yeah, continuity is one of those words that I detest. I talked about that in the book, and I talk about it elsewhere because it's a passive verb, and very little that we care about in terms of being Jewish should be constructed as in passive terminology. And it connotes this notion that somehow our job in the present is to continue that which we were handed, which does a few things. One is, psychologically, it starts placing barriers around innovation and creativity. Because if you feel that your job is to simply carry forth that which you were handed, you're much more likely to have a kind of conservative disposition around the possibility of changing what you've been given, because your job is to protect it and preserve it. And I find that that conservative impulse does not necessarily serve the needs of those who are going to receive whatever it is you're about to transmit. So I'm concerned about that passive term. And I also just find it to be, I find it to be inauthentic to so much of what is talked about as tradition itself. You know, classically, the great, you know, the opening text of the, you know, the first rabbinic version of storytelling their own history. So when the rabbis tell their own history, which is in the tractate called Ethics of the Fathers, the first text gives a kind of the rabbi's own version of an intellectual history, of their own intellectual history. And you know when you're reading it that it's that like any intellectual history, it's highly edited and highly selective because they want to show the authenticity of their own narrative. And yet even embedded within this traditional intellectual history, the rabbis say that they received, you know, that Moses received the Torah at Sinai and then transmitted it to Joshua. That is to say, in the first opening sentence, they use two totally different verbs for the activity of the transmission of the tradition, receiving and transmitting. And the significance of that is that, well, the minute that you tell somebody that two different verbs are involved in the passing down of something over time, you are hinting that something has to change in the very tradition as it passes over time. Because otherwise you would say he received it, and then the next people received it intact, and you would treat the tradition, or in our case Jewishness, as some sort of tangible object that never gets touched, tainted, or modified as it goes down. I think the rabbis plant the seeds, even in the context, again, of a traditional intellectual history, they plant the seeds of that transmission by necessity involves changing what it is that you see before.
So in talking about community, it brought to mind an interesting duality that I've read a little bit from you, and it's this idea of Genesis Jews and Exodus Jews. And if I understand it right, it relates a little bit to constructions of community. And I'd love to hear you expand on those two different types of folks that might each in different ways be thriving in contemporary Jewish life.
So this the idea of Genesis Jews and Exodus Jews is actually not my own. That's an idea from Rabbi Daniel Hartman, president of the Hartman Institute. I frame it sometimes a little bit differently, although it's possible that I've taught and quoted it. I think the idea that Daniel's been advancing using the language of Genesis and Exodus has been the story of the Jewish people as either essentially a family story, which would say that there is some intrinsic bond of family that exists independent of what that family actually does. And it's actually a pretty decent reading of the book of Genesis, given the fact that the family in the book of Genesis is completely dysfunctional and largely disobedient to what it is that God wants of them. And therefore, one of the underlying narratives of Jewish peoplehood is that this is the story of a particular family independent of the set of obligations that's supposed to befall that family. And then Exodus introduces a totally different paradigm altogether, which is it may start on the premise of being a family, but it transitions to a covenantal relationship with God that is tied into a set of beliefs, behaviors, and practices that people has to do in order to not only stay in relationship with God, but to stay in relationship to each other. And one of the great biblical questions is, does Exodus come to replace Genesis, or does it provide itself with a kind of radically different alternative to how community and people is actually constituted?
I'm thinking about the family question in terms also of the sort of changing demographics of the Jewish community in America, at the very least, and thinking about the continuing resonance of the family part of the story, when we have so many people potentially joining the community who are not genetically from that family. And are there ways, and that potentially, even beyond that, thinking about it as driven by a family story, maybe limits our openness to others in a way that actually doesn't serve us, both on a kind of, let's say, continuity agenda, which is, of course, problematic, or even more significantly, about a agenda of trying to maximize the power of the Exodus part, right? The power of the ideas, and that by denying ourselves the access to people who are going to help us develop these ideas in a new way for our times, we're limiting our capacity to really figure out how to weather the storm of the times in which we live. And so I'm wondering, is it, also maybe from a historical memory standpoint, are there times when it's sort of good to de-emphasize one or the other, do you think?
I'm struggling personally with the family metaphor. I've been struggling with a lot with it lately, especially over the past year or so. And I've started to be speaking and teaching about this a little bit more. And mostly as it emerges out of the Israel diaspora relationship, because more often than not, the metaphor of the Jewish people as family is deployed when talking about the American Jewish community's relationship with Israel. It's deployed as a negative criticism by some to others about their insufficient loyalties to family. It's rarely used as a means of celebrating the relationship between American Jews and Israeli Jews. It's more often used as one person saying to another person, how could you not treat these people the way you're supposed to, their family? And the only way that people hedge their bets around it is they say, we're family, but we're dysfunctional family. And that's supposed to kind of exonerate us from some of the guilt of this idea construct of the Jewish people as family. And as you know, I mean, I think that there's so much data to suggest that this language of family is problematic. One of which is, number one, I have a bunch of criticism, but I'll just give a couple. One is that we really relate differently to our families. And so imposing this almost totalitarian structure of a myth of family on a complex set of human relationships imagines that we both know what we're talking about when we use the term family, but we actually wind up implying really different things. A second critique is, we're just not ethnically the same families anymore, American Jews and Israeli Jews. That has to do with population and migration patterns in Israel, has to do with intermarriage and conversion in America, and it has to do with passage of time. So that, my parents had second cousins in Israel, but that means that my children only have fourth cousins in Israel. And the boundary past which we really know our cousins is probably third cousins. So if I don't see other people as actual family, how easy is it for me to inhabit the metaphor of family? And I think the most cogent argument against the family metaphor is that even if American Jews still believe and Israeli Jews still believe that we're in some ways part of the same family, we don't believe it in our actions. And, I challenged some folks in Palo Alto about this recently. I said, if you use the term family, will you actually pass the, let's call it the B'nai Brak test, that you would treat an ultra-Orthodox Jew in B'nai Brak who doesn't subscribe to any of your values or your politics and who doesn't necessarily recognize you as their family member, would you treat them differently with greater concern or empathy than your neighbors in Palo Alto who happen not to be Jewish? And I would say, push comes to shove, the answer is no, meaning people seem to want to hold on to the notion of family because it obligates their politics in a particular direction, but they don't actually buy it themselves.
When you were talking earlier, I was thinking about how you made the distinction earlier about, you know, that there's this distance between academia and practice. And one of the things that was really important to you was to try to bring those things closer through your work on sort of, I don't know what we might call it, but like practice-oriented thinking. And I'm wondering if there's maybe a couple of other stages that fall in between. And I'm trying to put together some of what we've been talking about on the podcast. And I'm thinking at least of two sort of pieces that fall between practice-oriented thinking and what you talked about, sort of the communal practice. And, you know, one, I would call it sort of the avant-garde art, right, is the idea that it's actually practice that's highly drawn from thinking, right? But it's not at all tied to this sort of, right? Avant-garde artists don't have to be concerned about the community because they don't want to be weighed down by anything, right? And then I feel like there's something between avant-garde and community, which is maybe we'd call it something like R&D, right? Which is the attempt to take the radical move that the avant-garde artist has made based on the radical thinking and try to turn it into something that's more practical and that might actually also be able to be kind of digested by the community, or whether it's the existing community or the nub out of which some new community will be created, inspired by the old. And then you get the sort of, okay, now let's put this into practice in the community and see if it doesn't break it.
Yeah, I mean, I think about the question that you're raising a lot in the context of our work and trying to figure out who we are as an institution in the Jewish landscape. And I think that your metaphor is an interesting one. I think it's hard, especially in the Jewish community in America, because our community thinks so often in policy terms or in program terms that it can be very difficult if somebody says something with a certain opinion to be able to allow that an opinion to exist outside of its policy implications. I find this to be the case all the time. I teach about things where I think what I'm doing is, you know, to use your language, I think that I'm being an artist, and people interpret it right away as, oh, therefore you subscribe to policy X. I'm like, no, that wasn't what I was trying to do. And that's a certain, I think there are institutions that are meant to do something different. I think we are, I think you are. But then there's a whole other business, which is how do you cultivate the capacity of our community to be able to understand the difference between the work of thinking and the work of ideation and the work of creating policy that is influenced by those ideas but isn't necessarily defined by it. On a structural level, you would say the avant-garde artist doesn't care if the people who follow the pioneering art that she creates are necessarily, you know, and who then create all sorts of, I don't know, a movement or an aesthetic on the basis of her innovations. The avant-garde artist may not care, but they probably do. She probably does. And you wonder how much the impact of creating policy does on a psychological level wind up impacting the creating of the art to begin with. You know, in our work, the metaphor that I've been playing with the last few months and talking to our staff about is not necessarily, I think the avant-garde art metaphor is an interesting one. I've been using the language of Intel, we don't really create, we don't create hardware for sure. And I'm not even sure how many of the apps or the software that we create. We're creating something that we hope lives inside the institutions, the individuals, and the leaders of the Jewish community that really informs, oftentimes defines, how they think about and how they create. But that whatever gets built up on top of those platforms doesn't cross-contaminate to what those platforms actually are. So you could have, you know, I hope that rabbis and Hillel directors, whoever else who comes to study us at the Harbin Institute, take what we're teaching them as the conceptual building blocks of innovating and transforming Jewish life, and that it's okay that those innovations and transformations are going to happen in different and possibly even opposing directions.
I'm struck by the ramifications of that, in that the same organization could lead to, at the extreme, diametrically opposing projects. I think that's really powerful and gets back to that point about sort of the expansiveness of what it, of maybe of Jewish family or of peoplehood. It brought me to a different metaphor that you talk about in Shuva, which is this metaphor of marbles. And it gets at some ideas about how in many ways, when we try to come up with one way, one definition, or even sort of a set of particular ways that collectively make up this thing called Judaism, it's a huge struggle. And I'm curious if you can expand on that marble metaphor and talk about ways that it might relate to some of the other themes that we've talked about so far.
Sure. The metaphor that I try to talk about in the book is that much of what constitutes the peoplehood conversation, the Jewish community, the question of who's in and who's out, I portray it as, imagine that there are marbles on a frictionless surface and they're moving in a variety of different directions, which I think expresses the pace of change and individual creativity and the human pursuit of meaning that exists within the framework of a lot of different people who are all marbles. That is, they all call themselves Jewish, but they're moving in radically different directions. And especially like in the modern period, post-emancipation, post-enlightenment, with many fewer obstacles to either creativity or political identity that existed in the past. You know, you might imagine that in a pre-modern period, the limit, you couldn't call the pace of change a frictionless surface. There's actually a lot of friction. And there were a lot of boundaries that were built around the Jewish community that limited the kind of diversity that would be possible. So we're all moving in different directions, and the people who are trying to create clear normative definitions around what the Jewish people are trying to draw circles on the floor that are big enough to capture all the marbles. But the marbles keep moving. And by the time you finish the classification process of those that are in, you've missed now thousands of marbles that were traveling faster than you could draw the circle. So that's the problem that we have. And so instead I asked, what if instead of defining peoplehood or defining the collective on the basis of the moving marbles, you imagine that collectivity is defined by what constituted what were the parameters or the core elements of the sack of marbles when you were still holding it in your hand before it ruptured and before all the marbles fell on the floor. In other words, what are the core elements that the marbles once shared in common, or, as I said before, mutual descendants of a shared ancestor? What are they all drawing from? What originated their what originated their kinship with the other marbles? And then you could potentially become much more tolerant of the fact that they're moving in a lot of different directions because they're all reflecting some, you know, for lack of a better word, organic manifestation of the places where a marble could go. Now, you could still be a little bit judgmental because you could say, you know, 1,000 marbles went in this direction and only 8 went in that direction. So there's probably some more strength in the marbles that are moving in this direction than others. Maybe there's some more legitimacy in that. But I become less concerned about creating those parameters and much more focused on the essential components. What are they sharing? What did they once share in common around which they are now moving in different directions? It means becoming more comfortable with diversity and disunity than our community has classically been. It's by definition a subversive idea.
You know, I want to take your metaphor of the marbles as you were talking about it, you know, from a definitional standpoint. I was thinking about it from a sort of why be Jewish standpoint. You know, I'm thinking that when the marbles were first all together, it was because there was a bag holding them together. And then in your metaphor, right, the bag broke and the marbles flew apart. And one option is to sort of try to find a bigger bag that could somehow grab them all, you know, or some versions of that. But it feels to me like it's a great metaphor, at least the way it's landing on me, because I'm saying, like, if you want those marbles back together again, it may be that you need a completely new way of bringing them back together again, right? It's not necessarily the question of looking back and say what tied us before, except insofar as if we discover, for example, that it turns out that the way those marbles models were made, they all have a metallic center, then we might know, so we need to bring an electromagnet, and that will be the new way of collecting those marbles back together again, right? The fact that the marbles have been dispersed, may introduce the need for a profoundly new way of collecting them. And I think we wonder if then the question is that new way of collecting them in line with sort of the reason why they should be collected in the first place? And maybe that's an overly extended way of essentially asking, that it seems, and this has been coming up a lot in our conversations on the podcast and with people about the podcast, has been this question of, okay, but why be Jewish going forward? What is it? Let's go to that Exodus question. What is it that really gives this whole endeavor purpose or a reason? I mean, what is, and obviously there's not going to be a single answer to that for everybody, but how do we even sort of address that line of questioning?
The only way to draw the marbles back together, the only way that has ever really worked in Jewish history that organizes the Jewish people against their will across their diversity has been through anti-Semitism. And it's the only way, because what anti-Semitism does is it introduces, or at least it amplifies, we can call the ontological argument about Jewishness, that Jewishness is something that cannot be defined as anything other than in reference to itself. And the easiest way to come up with that notion of Jewishness is for somebody else to say, you're that, and I'm going to coerce you into owning that identity. The what was a mortifying tragedy of the gas chambers was oftentimes people who had spent their lives fleeing from their Jewishness, finding themselves reclassified together with Jews who looked and acted Jewish. And it winds up being that the strongest electromagnet that holds these things together is our societies and individuals who insist that there is something ontologically other about you, that nothing you can do can actually get you away from that sensibility. The rabbis have this line, a Jew who sins is still remains a Jew, which is, and it kind of predates Shakespeare's, a rose by another name, etc. You can't lose your status of it. There's nothing you can do to lose your status of a Jewishness, but throughout Jewish history, people have tried. And the only thing that actually works at holding group identity back together winds up being anti-Semitism on the other end. And it's part of the reason that I am on one hand aware of that, and I struggle deeply with what it means to be a liberal person who tries not to be obsessed with anti-Semitism, who at the same time has to reckon with the fact that this seems to be some sort of poison or disease or not a bug but a feature of Western human consciousness that does not allow the Jew to become anything else but other. I think it's something we have to take much more seriously, but I am unwilling to allow it to be the central electromagnet of the project of trying to regroup Jews together. And as a result, I'm just skeptical about the activities of the regrouping, because I don't know that you'll ever be able to find a technology that actually holds us back together.
Essentially, I feel like in that metaphor, we now have sort of three possibilities, right? We have somehow the gathering back into some kind of bag, trying to find some way to get these people back together. It doesn't work very well for all sorts of reasons. The other, anti-Semitism is sort of a push, right? It's kind of an electromagnet from the outside with a reverse field or whatever we call that, and that pushes them back together again. But my question, I guess this is also a historical question. I'm thinking of the rabbinic period, the early rabbinic period, obviously it was over hundreds of years. Also the Second Temple period, which seems like that they were these periods that there was something magnetic about Judaism, that it didn't only attract Jews, right? That's also where I come back to this question of the Roman period, as I understand it, having been a time, the Second Temple period, of substantial conversion to Judaism, that there was something attractive about it. So I wonder if it's actually true that we don't have precedent for the idea that we could develop a Judaism that had a kind of gravitational attraction, and that should be our driving mission today.
That's fair. I think we're talking about slightly different things. I think one question is, what I was really responding to is the notion of like a central organizing principle that keeps everybody Jewish, and that I'm arguing against, and I think you'd probably agree. The second piece of, call it why be Jewish, or call it can you create magnetic forces that make Jewishness something more compelling that people want to be a part of? I totally agree, and I feel like that's my life's work. How do you fortify a tradition, a way of life, an orientation, et cetera, in such a way that it actually competes in the marketplace of ideas? I actually think the most innovative organizations on the Jewish landscape, whether they are legacy organizations that have pivoted or startup organizations, are those that don't operate on the premise of crisis or guilt, and those who basically say, here we are, we like this, we want to be a part of it, how do we make it a compelling discourse, compelling community, a language of meaning that other people will want to be a part of? And I agree with you, I see no reason why Judaism can't compete that way. I don't think there's a pure way to answer the question, why be Jewish? And I'm, as a result, I'm more and more skeptical of the question. And here I'll just be, like, I'll say personally, were I not born Jewish, would I care about this? I don't think so. I happen to have been born a particular way. I happen to be committed to my own family's history. I happen to be compelled by this story, and I happen to believe that Jewishness offers a richness and texture around human questions that are enduring and universal. And I think that our community doesn't do a great enough job at offering those up, because it still takes for granted that those who were born into the system or grew up in it have obligations and loyalties to it. So yeah, I believe in making that commitment to try to make Jewishness intellectually and affectively more compelling, and in the hope of doing so, you know, share your hope that it creates a gravitational pull over both those who happen to have been born in and maybe those who see it as a good option in the marketplace of ideas. But that very move, competing for people's attention, is the exact opposite of the assumption that there's some sort of magnetic force that will operate on people against their will.
In our closing minutes, the next series of episodes that we have coming up is exploring the holiday of Hanukkah as kind of a lens through which to look at some of the things that we're talking about. I was sort of thinking about Hanukkah and Purim, at least as I sort of speculate about them, that they functioned sort of in political ways for the Hasmonean kings, and that essentially I sometimes think about Purim as being the Holocaust day, right? It's sort of the day that tells us why it's important for us to be independent, because this kind of bad stuff happens when we're not. And Hanukkah having been sort of made into the independence day of the Hasmonean monarchy, the Hasmonean state. And I'm wondering if maybe there's an element there that Purim and Hanukkah, different from some of the other holidays, had more history attached to them in a way that makes them sort of more problematic holidays, or that maybe gives us other opportunities or other reasons why we really should consider some major surgery about them today so as to make them more meaningful a la the other holidays.
No, actually, I would say I think it's the opposite. I think you're right. They are the actually, from my perspective, those that that we've done a pretty good job at making them memory holidays rather than history holidays, and that they have become, in the past century alone, the most malleable traditional Jewish holidays that traditional people observe, precisely because they've been allowed to be played with. And it's not a coincidence that they're post-biblical Jewish holidays that are oriented around major historical events. One of my favorite all-time passages in all of scholarship is from Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi Zachor, when he talks about Hanukkah, and he references, and he's making the case for this notion of Jewish memory that he later in the book ultimately rejects, and basically says we've moved on past memory to a historical period. And in reference to Hanukkah, he refers to the rabbis in the Talmud talk about what's the blessing that one says on the, you know, on kindling the Hanukkah lamp? And they say, blessed are you, O Lord our God, who commanded us to kindle the Hanukkah lamp. And Yerushalmi points out, on what planet did God command anybody to kindle a Hanukkah lamp? It's a post-biblical Jewish holiday. And that the audacity, and he used that term, the audacity of the rabbis to imagine that a holiday around which they were creating ritual scaffolding was actually divinely ordained in command is extraordinary, and what I have been arguing is a template. You know, that's what you do. You don't come along and say, simply because this is a post-biblical holiday, we have to operate through a framework of history. It's precisely because it's a post-biblical holiday that you are obligated to treat it as though it's a biblical holiday and invest it with a kind of authenticity that enables you to make it more serious as opposed to making it more trivial. So I don't get hung up on, oh my God, Israel has turned Hanukkah into a militaristic nationalist holiday. Of course Israel made that what this holiday was about, because they were retrieving a narrative of Jewish history that served a particular moment that they're living in a Jewish history. That's Jewish memory. That's authenticity. Like, you're doing exactly what you're supposed to do to the Jewish past in making it come alive for a society that needs the mythic version of that story. And nor do I get particularly hung up on the American Jewish translation of Hanukkah into essentially a holiday of religious pluralism. Do I think that that's what's happening in the Book of Maccabees? No, I don't. I think the Book of Maccabees is about zealotry. But if I need the holiday in an American Jewish context to be one about religious pluralism, about light and darkness, about ecumenicism, great. If it's as long as that myth continues to serve the theological and political and spiritual needs of the people, then you're doing the activity correctly.
Well, on that note, Yehuda, thank you so much for spending this time with us. It's really a great it's a great privilege to learn with you anytime, and in particular for us in this project today. So thanks so much for being with us.
You got it. Anytime.
Thanks again to Dr. Yehuda Kurtzer of the Shalom Hartman Institute of North America for coming on to this episode of Judaism Unbound. As always, we want to close by encouraging our listeners to be in touch with us, and there's a few ways for you to do that. First is through our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second is you can head to our website, judaismunbound.com. Third, you can send us emails at dan@nextjewishfuture.org and lex@nextjewishfuture.org. And last but not least, we always want to encourage folks to send us a donation of whatever you are able to, and you can do that at judaismunbound.com/donate. So thanks again for listening, and this has been Judaism Unbound.